not the easiest thing in the world to accomplish. Okay, let's get some more light here. So, where were we? Last time we were discussing the causes for the high levels of inequality in the United States and persistent poverty. Now, the explanations for both of these apply not just to the United States. These are general sociological ideas about how to think about explaining inequality and poverty. And they have particular relevance for the United States because of the magnitude of these issues in the American context. We began by contrasting two broad families of explanations, blame the victim and blame society. Those are slogans, of course, blame the victim, blame society. The word blame has this moral connotation. Really, what's in play here is how do we explain poverty? Do you explain it by characteristics of the poor? Where to explain poverty is to explain what's different about poor people compared to others. That's the blame the victim. It means attributing the causes to the attributes of the poor. And the other, blame society, says, no, let's look instead of at the attributes of the poor, let's look at the attributes of society and see if there are properties of the way the society works that generates particular levels of poverty. I certainly place much more weight on the structural explanations, but I don't think by virtue of that the individualistic explanations about attributes of the poor are irrelevant, but they only make sense in the context of understanding how the society works, how the society creates the possibilities for poverty, and then the attributes of individuals may shape who ends up being poor. And that's why I use that perhaps silly example of the classroom grading system, where the attributes of the students explain who ends up being rich, getting the best grade, and who gets the worst grades. But in that extreme case, the attributes of persons doesn't at all explain the distribution of grades. That is the degree of inequality. The distribution of grades in that concocted example of the classroom was entirely due to the rules of the game of how grading was organized in the classroom. And remember from the very first lecture what I talked about what it means to think about things sociologically. At the very heart of thinking about things sociologically is understanding what the rules of the game are, how rules create outcomes, and how rules are enforced. So when we look at social structural explanations of poverty, what we're really doing is trying to understand how the rules of the game by which people get income are created in the society. And once those are understood, then we can ask the question, why do some people have a higher chance of being poor than others? These are separable questions. That's a general sociological idea, the distinction between explaining the fate of individuals and explaining the possible fates individuals can have. Do you get that contrast? Explaining why particular people end up where they do and why there are the places for them to end up. So what we're focusing on now are these structural explanations for poverty. And let's see if my pointer is going to work today. It didn't last time. And it doesn't look like it's doing it today either. Let's see. So, I said there were three kinds of social structural explanations. All three are important. They hit at different aspects of the problem. The first is the question of marginalization, exclusion from labor markets. And that's really what we ended up talking about. Marginalization means being pushed out. And the key thing that people are pushed out or excluded from that affects poverty is being excluded from access to jobs, either because the right kinds of jobs aren't available or people haven't been able to acquire the right kinds of skills. Now, marginalization, being excluded from good jobs or from jobs, actually by itself isn't quite enough to explain poverty. It explains why a person doesn't have access to jobs that generate income, but it doesn't explain why they're actually poor. And this is because of the third point on the slide, that the consequence of marginalization really depend upon what else is going on in the society. And in particular, if you happen to live in a society that has what's called a social safety net, which provides income for people even if they are marginalized from the employment structure, then they'll be marginalized, but they won't be poor. I mean, here's a slide which really quite dramatically illustrates this. The red bars indicate what the level, what proportion of the labor of the population are poor, defined by relative poverty. What percentage of the population are poor in Sweden and the United States before taxes and transfers? That is, before the public system intervenes to do any kind of redistribution. So you see, the United States and Sweden don't look that different. If Sweden had the American patterns of taxation and transfers, they would have more or less the same levels of poverty as we have in the United States. The difference between Sweden and the United States is because of what the poverty rate is after transfers occur. And that's a really important thing to remember. When you look around the world and you see some countries have much higher poverty rates than others, comparably wealthy countries, you know, countries that are in the same family of economies, it turns out that most of the difference between those countries is not in how their labor markets are organized. It's not really in how well-trained and educated their populations are. That has some effect, but the big difference is what they do about it. And this shows this, I think, quite starkly. So the first structural part of explanation of poverty is marginalization plus what the society does about marginalization. We can, the typical term that's used to describe that is the welfare state. I think that's a little, the term has some problems which we'll discuss later, but it basically has to do with the extent to which collectively we decide that people who have difficulty acquiring adequate skills or getting good enough jobs, whether they should be left on their own or we have a collective responsibility to see that their material conditions of life are made tolerable. The second category of structural explanations concerns inequalities within labor markets. So most adults do in fact get jobs. Most people are employed, even when you have a period of high unemployment. It's still the case that 90% of the people in the labor market, in the labor force in the United States, 92% of people in the labor force in the United States are employed. Unemployment rates are about 8%. Most people who want jobs get jobs, but they don't all get jobs of the kind that they want. So the question then is, how are wages connected to jobs? So people get jobs, but how are wages connected to jobs? How do we explain why some jobs pay much more than other jobs? You can imagine, I think, two kinds of systems through which wages are linked to jobs. So I'm going to give you, again, ideal types. Here's a contrast between two different ways that earnings get attached to the jobs and then people fill those jobs. One system could be called individualized competition. Everyone bids against everyone else. There's constant jockeying around. Employers can lower and raise wages at will as they compete for workers. So imagine a world of perfect competition. You get a job at a particular wage rate. Somebody else comes along and says to your employer, I'll do that job for $2 an hour less. and the employer comes to you and says, okay, do you want to, you willing to take a $2 pay cut? If not, you're out. There's no long-term contracts. Everything is negotiated constantly. Everybody's competing against everybody. That's an extreme case. It doesn't exist anywhere. That's one type of system. Let's call that individualized competition. Pure competition determines what wages get attached to jobs. In such a system, if employers can pay women less than men for the same work, there's no reason not to. Women are prepared to work for less, let's say, or minorities are prepared, or immigrants are prepared to work for less. No rules governing any constraint on the employer. Everything is just individual competition and individual bargains. That's one system. Another system is a labor market governed by rules. And the rules that govern labor markets mute the competition, dampens competition in one way or another. Minimum wages, for example. Minimum wages, that's a rule that's imposed on a labor market. A minimum wage law says employers are not allowed to pay less than this. It's a simple rule. If you impose minimum wage laws, you'll have a different wage structure in the job structure than if you don't have minimum wage jobs. If you have unions that protect workers with grievance procedures, which bargain collectively rather than individually, that's also changing the rules by which income gets attached to jobs. So both of these are two ideal types. The general idea, the key idea for the United States in recent decades has been the intensification of competitiveness in labor markets, which generates an escalation in inequality. The United States has always had a relatively unregulated labor market compared to most countries. It's always been much easier for employers to fire workers and to hire new workers at lower wages. It's always been easier to do that in the United States than in most other comparable countries. But the deregulation of labor markets has intensified in the last several decades. Why would then increased competition, an increased intensity of competition within labor markets, why would this lead to greater inequality? Why do you think? Just give some reasons. Think of some reasons why intensification of competition would produce more inequality. Americans like to think that competition is a good thing. Therefore, more competition is even better. Right? If competition is good, intense competition should be even better. Is that really true? Why do you think about some reasons. Anyone? Reasons why an intensely competitive market will produce a bigger spread in wages. That is, you'll have more inequality when you have intense competition. Any ideas? Nobody has a clue. This is not such a deep and mysterious problem. Somebody, venture forth. Okay, turn to this will take a little more time. Turn to the people immediately next to you. 2 minutes, talk to your neighbors. Think about it. Come up with some ideas. Why does competition generate more inequality? Okay. Now, some answers. Since a lot of you are talking, I might even just point to somebody if somebody doesn't raise their hand. Come on. Somebody, there were some ideas I could hear buzzing, buzzing, buzzing. There's ideas out there. But we're asking why the good jobs begin to pay even more. So competition needs to be thought of in two ways. One is it says who gets to the top. The question here is, why does it make the top further up? The competition is doing two things. It sorts people, and it changes the, if you have intense competition, it changes the nature of the outcomes as well. Yeah.
$2 that the employer isn't paying to hire that worker is going back to the employer.
Okay, so one thing is that if you have competition that pushes the bottom down, it leaves more resources to use for other things, one of which might go into the pocket of the employer, but there's another thing which the employer can do with those extra resources. The employer can start bidding more for the best talent. So, I mean, here's just the basic way to think about this. If you have a world where people are following a set of regulations or norms, that's expectations, about what's the appropriate range of income, and not heavily competing about income, about wages, they're competing for jobs, but they're not constantly jockeying to try to push up their job, their income. That means that there will be an upper bound and a lower bound to what is considered the proper pay for particular jobs. If you have unregulated competition, people at the top push the income up because they're prepared to compete ruthlessly to increase their wages, and people at the bottom push the wages down so the spread increases. In academic life, I've been a professor for 35 years. The level of competition among academics has increased tremendously in the time that I've been a professor. It used to be considered really bad behavior, kind of seedy, for a professor to look for outside offers from other universities in order to get universities competing with each other to raise their salary. It's now common practice. Professors behave like athletes. Professional athletes. If you're a star professor, you'll let it be known to other universities that you might be interested in moving. The other universities then offer you a big pay raise. You go to your dean and say, I'll stay if you match this offer. That used to be considered really bad behavior, inappropriate for an academic. The previous norm was much more we're a collective community. Wage differences aren't that great between the most senior and famous faculty and the least famous. And that's fine because it produces a kind of culture in which earning as much as possible isn't the main thing, the main reason why you're in the business. That's very much eroded in the last three decades. And it reflects this general sense that of intensification of competition. We've also moved into a kind of economic environment that's sometimes called a winner-take-all market. This is a complicated story. There's a very interesting book called Winner-Take-All, which those of you who are interested, I think, will find it worthwhile to read. The best example of a winner-take-all market are certain kinds of athletic competitions. If you win the 100-yard dash by a hundredth of a second, you get the gold medal. The person who comes in second gets way less chance for endorsements. Winning the gold medal is worth millions of dollars. And the difference in performance between winning the gold medal and winning the silver medal can be a hundredth of a second. A winner-take-all market means that the payoffs for being the best are way out of proportion to the difference between being the best and being second best. And sometimes it's completely arbitrary. I mean, a hundredth of a second can't really reflect differences in effort there's the meaning of effort with respect to a hundredth of a second is sort of vanishingly meaningless. In the American context, the deregulation at the bottom end of the labor market has been hugely important. The minimum wage has basically collapsed. It's currently, I believe it's currently $7.25. I think that's the current minimum wage. If the minimum wage of the late 1960s had increased at the same pace as average wages in the United States, the minimum wage today would be $12.50. That is, if the economy of the 1960s, if we took the economy of the 1960s and simply scaled up everything to the present, simply with the average growth of wages, not the average growth of productivity, just the average growth of wages, the minimum wage today would be $12.50. When you get rid of a minimum wage and $7.25 is almost like not having a minimum wage, that pulls the whole bottom of the labor market down. Why then has there been this intensification of competition? Why has competitiveness in labor markets increased so much? Well, there's a variety of reasons for this. The decline of unions is certainly important. In the last 40 years, the labor movement has not disappeared, but it has tremendously declined to the point that well under 10% of the private labor force are currently unionized. There's also been a serious decline of government regulation of labor markets, especially with the minimum wage. But it's also the case that employment of labor law itself has declined in the United States, and this affects the overall labor market structure. And finally, increased global competition has meant that American workers are in a situation where they are effectively competing for wages and jobs with workers around the world in ways in which they weren't before. And this also puts downward pressure at the bottom of the labor market, thus increasing the overall spread of wages among wage earners. Another kind of argument for why the inequality among jobs has increased centers around technological change and especially the increasing importance of education and skill. I think this is tremendously exaggerated as an explanation for the increasing inequality. The increasing inequality among professionals, for example, has increased enormously. And it's pretty hard to make the argument that the reason why among doctors today there is way more inequality than there was 40 years ago is because somehow there's more skill differential among doctors. It's because we've organized medicine in such a way as to produce inordinate rewards to certain kinds of specialties in certain kinds of institutions relative to other kinds of specialties in other kinds of institutions. The third source of persistent inequality centers around wealth inequality. So remember, what we're doing is exploring the blame the society kinds of explanations, the social structural explanations of inequality. The first was marginalization. The second was inequalities generated inside of the labor market. The third centers around wealth inequality. Here, I think the story is pretty simple. It's pretty difficult for most people to accumulate much wealth through savings. The stagnation of household income since the 1970s, basically household income has been pretty much flat, a little bit of increase in periods of expansion and decline in periods of recession. But if you recall that overall graph of household income, it's been pretty flat in the last 40 years or so, which means that most people don't have much discretionary income to spend on savings, and savings are what gets turned into wealth. On the other hand, the fantastic rise of earnings at the high end of the labor market has allowed professionals and managers and even some professors, to turn their surplus earnings into capitalist wealth by buying stocks and bonds and other kinds of investments. Wealth inequality, then, is generated by the fact that most people are unable to save enough to accumulate the resources needed for investments. And on the other hand, huge growth in income inequality has allowed top earners to turn their discretionary income, the income above and beyond what they need to live the standard of living they want, into the accumulation of wealth. And that has pushed up wealth inequality, not just income inequality, over the past generation. Okay. Let's shift gears and talk about solutions. Well, what should we do about it? Now, some people say we shouldn't do anything about it. There is a view, which is certainly prominent in conservative political circles, which says it's inappropriate for government to try to reduce poverty or to reduce inequality. And if anything, the argument goes, we should reduce regulation, increase competition, and put more responsibility on the shoulders of individuals for their own fates. And if we do so, perhaps that will reduce poverty because people will have incentives to work harder because of the desperate conditions they would live in if they didn't. But if it doesn't, well, it's basically there's nothing that government should do for the various kinds of reasons which I'm sure you're all familiar and which we've talked about before. In order to do something about it, you have to increase taxes. You increase taxes, you're taking money away from people who work hard and giving it to people who do not. So there's one answer to the question, what are the solutions to poverty and inequality is, on the one hand, inequality isn't a bad thing. Who cares? And on the other hand, the only possible legitimate solution to poverty is continued economic growth that will eventually benefit everybody. Now, as we saw from those earlier graphs about how economic growth affects different parts of the income distribution, in the 25 years after World War II, it was indeed the case that general economic growth benefited everybody. The bottom 20% of the income structure grew as rapidly as the top 5%. But in the last 40 years or so, it is simply not the case. We've had a lot of economic growth since 1980, and almost none of it has benefited people at the bottom. And there's no reason whatsoever to imagine that that's going to change in the future. It is simply not true. So, you know, it's a strong claim. This is false. I'm prepared to say it for this. It is simply not the case that economic growth has any automatic consequences for the well-being of people at the bottom. And to rely on economic growth, or what's sometimes called trickle-down economics, that is, let the rich get richer because that will trickle down and make the poor better off, in some historical moments it does so, and in other historical periods it doesn't. And in the historical period we're living in now, there's absolutely no reason to believe that economic growth by itself is going to solve the problem of persistent poverty, let alone reduce what I would characterize as excessive inequality. So to begin this discussion, I think it's important to get clear what we're talking about when we're asking public authority, the government, which is basically asking ourselves as a collective, as a community, to do something about it. The word welfare has become kind of a dirty word in American politics. Welfare is viewed as a form of dependency. No one should be on welfare. But what really is welfare? What are we really talking about when we talk about welfare? The word itself means well-being, the welfare of people. It means well-being. And to talk about government welfare means the government are doing various things which enhance well-being for one reason or another. Here's how I would define government welfare as a general matter. Government welfare is any government subsidy to a particular group of people which provides them with an economic benefit that they would not have had if things were just left up to the market. So welfare is a subsidy that goes to some group that gives a benefit that they would not have had if things were just left up to the market. It's an intervention, requires the government taking resources from the society as a whole, we call that taxation, and giving it to particular groups of people that gives them a benefit they wouldn't have otherwise had. Now, when you think about welfare in that way, one question is, who actually are the main recipients of welfare? What are the groups of people who receive most systematically and persistently government-provided benefits that enable them to do things that they would not have been able to do if they had to rely entirely on the market? Well, this may not seem intuitive to most of you, but virtually all of you, except those of you who are foreign students, and even foreign students receive a little bit of U.S., a little bit of government welfare, but every student at the University of Wisconsin is a welfare recipient. All of you are welfare recipients. Even if you're paying full out-of-state tuition, you're still welfare recipients. Because out-of-state tuition doesn't cover the cost of your education. It's not sufficient to cover the full cost of your education. If you had to pay at the University of Wisconsin full tuition, it would probably be somewhere in the vicinity of $45,000 a year. That's a rough guess. I don't know what the current percentage of the total per student cost of education is by full out-of-state tuition, but it's way less than covering the full costs. And I imagine that for many of you, that would have created a problem for your parents or for your other sources of income to have covered your costs. Now, we can say, yes, this is a good thing because higher education is a public good. Having a highly educated population is a good thing. Having more university graduates is a good thing. It's a public good. It has positive externalities. That is, it's not just good for you, but it's good for the society to have more people like you. That is, people who become highly educated. You develop meta skills. You learn how to learn as a student. That's a good thing. It makes you a more flexible person in the labor market. It'll make it easier for the American economy to develop in unexpected ways if we have highly educated people than if we didn't. So there's good justification for these subsidies. But that doesn't make them not subsidies, to enable benefits which you receive that you would not have been able to receive if you had to rely on the market. Welfare, therefore, is not just something that goes to poor and disadvantaged people. There are two main types of welfare spending. If we define welfare as subsidies provided by the tax system, that is, taxes raise revenues and then they're given to particular purposes. The simplest is just direct public spending. Food stamps, public housing, cash transfers, tuition subsidies, all of these direct payments, the direct spending of tax money to benefit people. That's the simplest. There's also something a little more complicated called tax subsidies. Things like the mortgage deduction. Mortgage deductions means that if you have a mortgage on a house and you're paying interest, you can deduct your interest payments from your income so that you don't pay taxes on it. We'll be talking more about this in a session on taxation next month, but if you pay $1,000 a month in interest payments on a mortgage and your tax bracket is 25%, that means every time you spend $1,000, you get a $250 check from the government. The way to think about the mortgage tax deduction is that the government is paying you $250 a month in order for you to have more affordable housing. That's what a tax deduction is. It's a government payment to you done through the tax code, because that's a simple way of doing it. Mortgage deductions are a form of welfare for homeowners. Deductions of business expenses as a form of welfare for businesses. Again, done through the tax code. Those are called tax subsidies. So we have these two kinds of welfare spending, direct government spending and tax subsidies. Many of these go to groups that are already privileged. It's not the case, it's kind of obvious once you think about it, it's not the case that government subsidies through the tax system primarily go to people who are disadvantaged in the world. Here are just some examples. Tuition subsidies, I've already mentioned. Homeowners, that's another example. 48% of mortgage subsidies go to the top 20% of the income distribution. Mortgage subsidies taken as a whole are four times greater than spending on public housing for the poor. So if we say, okay, we have a welfare system that's concerned with housing, housing is an important good. Housing is, I think, an entitlement. People have a right to be housed. I don't think, in a rich country, I think everybody has a right to food and medical care and housing. We have two ways that we recognize the importance of housing in people's lives: by having government spend its resources, meaning our collective taxes, on housing. One is by giving housing subsidies to relatively affluent people, and the other is by giving housing subsidies to relatively poor people. We give four times as much to people who are homeowners than we do to people who need public housing of one sort or another. And almost half of the public money spent on housing for homeowners goes to the richest 20% of the population. That's an important feature of our welfare system. Farm subsidies, $30 billion a year. This is probably a few years out of date, but it's still the right order of magnitude. 80% of farm subsidies goes to corporate agriculture, not to family farmers. The defense of agricultural subsidies is always in terms of the defense of the family farm. But in fact, overwhelmingly, farm subsidies go to corporations, agricultural corporations. And of course, what's called corporate welfare, direct subsidies to the oil industry, to other industries, amounts to $75 billion a year, more or less. Now, I personally don't think there's anything wrong with corporate welfare. You know, you might be surprised about that. I'm supposed to be this hard-hitting radical leftist, right? I think it's just fine to subsidize corporations if there's good public policy reasons for it. That is, if subsidizing a corporation serves a public good because the subsidy will have positive externalities, then it's fine. The fact that it's a corporation that's being subsidized isn't important. What matters is what are the consequences of the subsidy. I think the homeowner subsidy is probably, on balance, a pretty good thing. What I object to about it is the opposition by homeowners to public subsidies to poor people's housing. That's what's wrong with the mortgage deduction. It's not that it's bad public policy to subsidize homeowning. I think homeowning is a good thing. It helps to create more stable communities. It helps to have people feel more ownership in their immediate world. If you own a home, that's a good thing. So subsidizing mortgages is fine. What's wrong is the double standard. It's fine to subsidize homeowning, but not to subsidize public housing. And the same thing I would say for so-called corporate welfare. There's good corporate welfare and there's bad corporate welfare. I think it's probably bad public policy to subsidize oil companies because they are extremely profitable and it's not the direction of energy development that is most important from a public goods point of view. Whereas it's probably, my guess would be, I haven't looked at it closely, but it's corporate welfare to renewable energy sources is probably a good thing. It's probably a necessary way of getting more investment into that sector. I'm going to skip these examples of corporate welfare. They're discussed in the book. Let's look at solutions to poverty. There are three types of solutions to poverty. You can see that they're numbered 1, 1, and 2. It should be 1, 2, and 3. The first is to partially decouple standards of living from the market earnings by increasing the social wage. I'll explain that in a moment. So the first is decouple standards of living from wages. The second is to partially decouple paid employment from the market. And the third is to decouple income from earnings. So each of these solutions involves weakening a particular kind of connection. Decoupling standards of living from earnings, decoupling paid employment from the market, and decoupling income from earnings. Let me explain each of these. Taken all together, these would significantly reduce, I think we could even completely eliminate, poverty in the United States. I should say, I could make that even stronger. There is no question, it is absolutely certain that we could, if we wanted to, eliminate poverty in the United States. But there might be reasons why we might decide we didn't want to. There could be other values in play or other kinds of costs that could lead one to say, yes, we could do this, but we shouldn't. Okay, let me explain what these three kinds of processes are, these three types of mechanisms. First, partially decoupling standards of living from the market. The idea of a standard of living is all the things that you consume that constitute the quality of life in which you live. So think of your standard of living comprehensively. Don't think of your standard of living as just what you can buy, but your standard of living is all the ways in which you can have your needs satisfied. For everyone, or virtually everyone, their standard of living comes from two components: their consumption of private goods and their consumption of public goods. So when you visit a national park or a Wisconsin state park, when you visit a public park and enjoy the amenities of a park, that is fulfilling a need. If you were very wealthy, you could have a private park, right? There was a time in history when only the very wealthy had parks. Kings had royal parks. Nobody else did. We have public parks. Public parks are part of our collective standard of living. Now, if you are an outdoorsy type person, and camping and hiking and canoeing, and these are important parts of the quality of your quality of life, then actually a whole lot of your consumption isn't based on your income. It's not private consumption. A whole lot of your consumption is the consumption of a public good. And if suddenly the parks were closed and they were turned over to private entrepreneurs who would charge market rates for your particular use, they wouldn't be supported by taxes. They would have to be entirely supported by the fees charged to people who use them. Vast numbers of people whose quality of life has a strong component of public parks would suddenly be way poorer. they would be much poorer in terms of their overall standard of living. So you get that point? Let me take another example. Swimming pools. One model for how people should have swimming pools is everybody should build their own swimming pool in their own backyard or join country clubs if they want bigger pools. No public provision of swimming pools whatsoever. High schools wouldn't have swimming pools. That's a public good. Only private provision of swimming pools. Well, if swimming was an important part of your standard of living, suddenly people for whom that's important would become much poorer. So this first way of thinking about what we could do about poverty is to expand this broad domain of public goods as part of our consumption, as part of our definition or the components of our basic standard of living. This is sometimes referred to as the social wage, as opposed to your private wage. Universal health care in every country except the United States is provided as a part of the social wage. Public libraries are part of our social wage. Madison has a fantastically good public library system. The United States in general does. It's one of the nice little anomalies in American society that we have among the world's best public libraries. And for people who consume reading and other informational materials through libraries, that becomes a part of their standard of living. Many parts of the world until recently had free universities. Nobody paid tuition. Introducing tuition into European universities is a relatively recent phenomenon. That's an increase in the standard of living of people, to have free universities. It's an increase in the standard of living of people who otherwise couldn't afford universities. Of course, it reduces the standard of living of people whose taxes have to be higher in order to pay for those universities. All right, that's the first general kind of solution to poverty and inequality. Let's just expand the domain of the social wage, of individual access to public goods as part of their consumption. To the extent that you do that, people rely less heavily on their private income in order to have an adequate standard of living. That is, of course, one of the important ideas behind public education altogether. The reason why we have universal free public education in the United States is the belief that a person's access to education should not be contingent upon their ability to pay for it privately. So we have already in the United States some pretty large domains of public goods as part of our individual standards of living. The idea here would be to, as one way of thinking about how you could reduce poverty, would be to expand the domain of public goods. Secondly, partially decouple paid employment from the capitalist market. This basically means expanding public sector employment. Now, this has really gotten a bad name in the United States. You know, we hear constantly this mantra that the government never creates jobs, only the private sector creates jobs, which is a kind of absurd idea because, of course, the public sector creates jobs. 20% of the labor force in the United States is employed by the public sector. Those jobs wouldn't exist if it wasn't created by the public sector. Public sector creates jobs all the time. It may create good jobs or bad jobs, jobs that are useful or unuseful. But the idea that the government can't create jobs is, I think, literally a meaningless claim. It's not just wrong, it doesn't make sense. Clearly, the government can create jobs. The question, of course, is whether the overall mix between the government providing jobs and the private sector providing jobs is the mix that maximizes the welfare, the well-being of the population as a whole. What's the best mix that we want? One can certainly imagine a situation in which there are too many public sector jobs because the people in those jobs aren't doing anything useful. The United States has the smallest public sector of any developed capitalist economy. We have fewer people being paid directly, employed directly by state, local, and federal government. And one way to deal with the problems of low-wage employment and the lack of jobs adequate for people with low levels of skill, one way of dealing with that is simply to have the direct creation of jobs that are appropriate for people with those low levels of skill. Now, this is a, along with many other things I'm saying, a very controversial idea. Should we, if we have lots of people with relatively limited education and relatively low skills, should we try to remedy the problem of lack of employment for those people by trying to upgrade everybody's skills, or by trying to directly create jobs that are appropriate for people with that level of skill? If there was nothing of use to be done in the world that required the kinds of skills, low levels of skills that a certain part of the population might have, if there was no useful work to be done, then I think it would be a mistake to create those jobs. The point is not to create jobs that are meaningless jobs, but to create jobs that have a good social purpose. Even in a knowledge society like the one we are heading into, with the high tech and information density of our systems of production, even in this world that we live in, there's vast amounts of works that don't require high levels of education and don't require high levels of cognitive complexity. There's vast amounts of things that need to be done in terms of rehabilitation of cities, the retrofitting of housing for energy conservation, the rebuilding of infrastructure, the maintenance of parks and ecological systems, not to mention the expanding needs for elder care and child care. There's lots of things to be done. And the question is, should we provide jobs so that those things do get done? And should those jobs be provided by public authority, by our collective capacity to employ people? Or should they be employed only if the market wants to employ them? Well, as I think should be clear, for all of these public goods aspects of activity, markets generally do not provide adequate economic activity to produce public goods. If these needs are real, it's perfectly justified to allocate social resources to employ people. By a significant expansion of the public sector in the United States, if the U.S. public sector were brought up to the same levels of most other countries, that would have a very big impact on the availability of well-paying jobs at the bottom of the labor market. So that's a second kind of solution to the problem of poverty, to rely less exclusively on the private market to generate employment that provides adequate wages, less exclusive focus on the private market, and to take seriously the expansion of good, productive, meaningful jobs provided by the public sector. Of course, that has to be paid for. And the paying for it requires taxation. And so if you decide that it's impossible to raise taxes because there's some either moral or economic objection to having higher taxes, then you can't create these kinds of jobs to solve this kind of problem. Again, we will be discussing taxation and the logic of taxation and the nature of taxation as a constraint. We'll be discussing that in a few weeks. Finally, there's a third type of solution, labeled two, but it's three, which is to partially decouple income from earnings. Now, this is the most controversial. You know, public sector employment might seem controversial enough, you know, since in the United States that's seen as a bad thing. Decoupling income from earnings is an even more controversial idea. I'm going to, in a moment, describe a particular form of decoupling income from earnings called basic income grants, which I think is a really interesting idea. And even if one doesn't particularly like it, it's worth thinking about. But there are other things besides basic income. Just to give you one example of something that has been tried and I think has some pretty interesting implications, these are called asset development accounts. The Ford Foundation ran an experiment, it may still be going on, I'm not sure, in which poor people were given an incentive to save even out of the very limited funds they had by having every dollar of their savings matched with $2 from the Ford Foundation. So if you saved $1,000, you'd end up with $3,000. And then there were various restrictions on your access to the money. You'd be putting it into a long-term account rather than a short-term account. Now, it was based on a premise that poor people didn't save because they didn't have a habit of saving. I don't think that was a very plausible explanation for the lack of savings on people who are very poor and have very little income. But it was the case that with that level of incentive, you really tell people, okay, if you can scrape together $100, we'll triple it in your savings account. That did create an incentive, and it had the effect of partially decoupling their income from their earnings. You see how it means that part of their income comes from something other than what they're earning, these matching funds. The Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a government tax policy in the United States, I think a very good one, gives people who work and earn in the low-wage sector a kind of negative income tax. They get a tax credit when they file their tax returns rather than having to pay taxes. They are net recipients rather than net payers of taxes through what's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. I think an Earned Income Tax Credit is an extremely good program. It was it was started at a low level in the 1980s and increased quite a lot in the 1990s. And I believe it was even increased somewhat during the Bush administration. I'm not sure about that. Okay, let me tell you about unconditional basic income. Here's the idea. Three principles. It's a basic income that provides for a decent, no-frills standard of living above the poverty line. It's universal. It's given to every citizen. In some schemes, given to every legal resident, not just citizen. And it's unconditional. There's no work requirements, no restrictions. Everybody gets it. You get it if you're rich. You get it if you're poor. Everybody gets the basic income unconditionally, and it is set at a level that if that you could live on it at the no-frills standard of living. Unconditional basic income is an example of what's called a universal program. It's worth keeping in mind this contrast. A means-tested program is a program in which the benefit only goes to someone if you fall below a particular level of income. Food stamps are an example. Your income has to be below a certain level, otherwise you can't get food stamps. Pell grants are an example. You can only get a Pell grant if your income falls below a certain level. Then you can get a student loan in the form of a Pell grant. Those are means-tested programs. Universal programs are programs in which everybody gets the benefit regardless of income. Medicare is a universal program. Every elderly person, everybody over 65 in the United States gets Medicare if they want it without any means test. It's a universal program. So is public education. Basic income is an example of a universal program. Now, one might think if you're concerned about poverty, it would be much better to have programs that are targeted for the poor rather than universal. But there are problems with means-tested programs. Means-tested programs, if you have a income transfer program that only goes to poor people, the program itself is associated with stigma. Recipients are labeled negative. people don't want to be a welfare recipient if welfare only goes to people who fall below a certain level. Means-tested programs generate a weak basis for public support. Universal programs build bridges across groups. Means-tested programs emphasize the cleavage between groups. Universal programs are much more likely, once they are in place, to be experienced as rights, whereas means-tested programs generally are viewed as charity. If you think about Medicare, as an example, most people, not all, but most people see Medicare as now a right. If you're a senior citizen, you have a right to Medicare. In the debates over healthcare reform, there were these famous quotes of people telling the government to keep hands off my Medicare. Of course, it's a government program. It's not a program that exists independently of government. Universal programs become viewed as rights. The result is that universal programs usually do more to help the poor than means-tested programs. There's an expression in the policy circles about this, which is that programs targeted at the poor are poor programs. Universal programs get broader public support, they build bridges across groups, and once they're stabilized and in place, they receive much broader public support, and therefore they're harder to undo once they are in place. Well, let's examine basic income. So just imagine, you could snap your fingers, and every person in the United States, let's say every legal resident, would have a monthly flow of income sufficient to live above the poverty line, to live at a no-frills but respectable minimal standard of living. What are the potential consequences? First, just let me make one comment. There's two kinds of discussions one can have about basic income. One is, if it would work, is it a good thing? And the second thing is, would it work? So one kind of objection to basic income is that it's simply a fantasy. It would not work. If you had a basic income, the whole society would fall apart. That's a pragmatic objection. Remember, when we discussed various arguments earlier in the semester, we drew this distinction between moral arguments and pragmatic arguments. So one problem, which I'll discuss in a moment briefly, about basic income is maybe it won't work. But another issue is, even if it would work, is it a good thing? People might object to basic income as being wrong, as being bad policy, as being immoral, even if it would work. So let me first just briefly indicate some of the possible consequences, the potential consequences of basic income if it was actually in place, and then talk briefly about the pragmatic question of whether or not it will work. First of all, and most important in the present context, if it would work, basic income would eliminate extreme poverty without stigma. There would be no stigma because everybody gets the basic income. You know, so nobody would be stigmatized for receiving this monthly payment because everybody receives the monthly payment. Of course, if you're wealthy, you receive the monthly payment, but your taxes go up more than your payment. You're a net contributor. And if you're poor, you receive the monthly payment, and your taxes don't go up as much as the monthly payment, so you're a net beneficiary. But still, everybody gets it, so it doesn't have stigma. Secondly, it facilitates non-market activity in all sorts of ways. Currently, after many of you graduate, many of you will want to do internships, and many internships are unpaid. They're basically non-market activity. They're volunteer work for a company, for a government agency, for a nonprofit. In the present world, only people who have parents who can afford to give them a basic income can afford to do internships. In a world with basic income, everybody could do an internship. In the arts, people would be able to engage in the performing arts and other kinds of artistic and literary activities without having to necessarily have a day job. That is, the basic income would provide a minimal standard of living in order to underwrite the arts without having to have any agency decide whether your artistic activity is worthy or not. So the universal quality means it enhances your freedom. Think of unconditional basic income as a freedom grant. It enhances your freedom to engage in artistic activities according to your own desires. It therefore gives everybody a measure of real freedom. If you think of basic income as a freedom grant, as generalizing the principle that freedom is a central value and everybody should have basic freedom, basic positive freedom, not just negative freedom, unconditional basic income is a kind of positive freedom grant to everybody. Unconditional basic income makes unpleasant work more costly. In the current labor markets, lousy work that's unpleasant is also badly paid. Well, if people had a basic income, unpleasant work would become more expensive because people would have an exit option. It increases the bargaining power of people over the conditions of work, not just over wages. And it therefore puts pressure on employers to innovate to eliminate unpleasant, boring work because it becomes more costly. Those are all potential benefits of an unconditional basic income. But of course, there's the big question, will it work? There are two kinds of arguments why it won't work. Too many people will stop working for pay, and thus not enough income will be generated to sustain the system. And taxes to pay for it will be so high that there will be huge disincentives to invest. Those are the two pragmatic arguments against basic income. That says it simply won't work. It'll cost too much in taxes, so nobody's going to invest in the economy anymore. And too many people have as their deepest ambition in life to be couch potatoes and watch television all day. So they will simply withdraw from the labor market and fritter their lives away doing nothing. Now, if these expectations are true, if this is actually what happens, then basic income is a fantasy. It's not a solution to poverty because it's not a possible social innovation. I think both of these are tremendously exaggerated. The amount of taxation needed to pay for basic income turns out to not be as high as you would think, because if you have basic income, all sorts of other income support programs can be eliminated. You don't need Social Security, for example. You know, talk about reforming Social Security. If you have a basic income, which goes to everybody, that provides enough income to live above the poverty line, then you don't need Social Security anymore. You don't need all sorts of other targeted, means-tested welfare programs that we currently have. So basic income replaces a whole lot of stuff, and it's administratively very simple. It's very cheap to administer, so you save on overhead costs as well. Well, I can't here give you a full defense about these two objections. These are serious objections. They can't be dismissed out of hand. But I think, in fact, if you really think carefully about them, they don't provide good grounding for rejecting basic income as a fundamental transformation of the way income is distributed and poverty is dealt with in our society. See you next week.